president emeritus of the IBM Academy and one of the real wise men of industry as far as I'm concerned. And if there's any company in some senses that epitomizes the shift from a deeply proprietary strategy, still the largest patent holder in the United States, IBM, shifting over to a wholehearted embrace along different layers, both internal and external, of open, collaborative models of production, both internally and in reliance on free and open source software, and with engagement with the free software community. It's IBM, and if there's any single person in a large organization, it's always hard to say that there's any single person. But if there's any single person who can be said to have been the architect and wise man behind that choice, it's Irving. So it's just an utter delight and honor to have you here, and we'd love to hear you talk about participatory governance.
Thank you, it's a pleasure for me to be here. And the first three sections of my talk, I'm going to go relatively quickly. I want to set the context for the fourth section in the first three, because it's very important, as we talked about governance models, and particular participatory governance models, to sort of say, what is it that I have in mind, and why is it that we need it? So let me start by giving you my view of the market environment in which we are. And there is nothing I'm saying you don't know. So I'm going to go very quickly, and if at any point you have a question, please stop me. So we're living in a world that is increasingly global and integrated, market-facing, service-oriented, complex and unpredictable. When we think in terms of systems today, when we talk to a business about systems, when we talk to an industry, we really mean a global integrated system in which we want to link together all processes, all information, and all people. Not just within one enterprise, but since an enterprise lives within an industry ecosystem, it's very important that they be linked to suppliers and vendors and everybody else. And what is really coming out is this is all a digital economy. So keep in mind this whole notion of thinking about governance given the incredible complexity of these global integrated business and systems. Now, in the industrial economy, you generally thought about applying technology, engineering methodology, system thinking to the components, to machines, and then to the products that you built with them. And then you generally thought that everything on top of that, applications and the business itself, was services-based, labor-based, much more ad hoc. One of the most fascinating changes taking place is that we are trying to apply system thinking to organizational systems, that by definition, the components of this organizational system are people performing services for each other, and organizational systems are very different from classic engineering-based systems like an airplane or a building with lots and lots of components. And the key difference is that the components in anything that is a physical engineered system are deterministic, and the whole system may be frightfully complicated, but it's deterministic. I mean, when you design a plane, the plane doesn't argue back with you that it doesn't like what you're doing to it. And you know, the plane does what you tell it to do. It may be huge number of parts, but it is deterministic. Whereas, as we are applying more and more system thinking to this market-facing, people-oriented systems, where by definition people are the components, it's going to be unpredictable because the people are unpredictable. They are not deterministic. Now, it doesn't mean, therefore, there is nothing you can do. There is a huge amount you can do, and these are more stochastic systems. You can apply data mining, predictive things, lots of stuff, but they are very different kinds of systems than the systems down here. As I think economists have been learning that, it's okay to apply rational economics to a machine. I think we're learning that you apply rational economics to a human-based organizational system at your peril, because humans are not very rational. And the consequence of this incredible complexity and the market-facing aspect of the systems is that what we have is unpredictable. I mean, it's mathematically unpredictable. We have systems that have nonlinear dynamics. You have to apply nonlinear stochastic models to understand how they behave, and they are unpredictable. By the way, we know how to deal with unpredictable systems in the sense that hurricanes are highly nonlinear systems, but notice that the way the Weather Bureau deals with hurricanes is they show you cones of probability, and they keep redoing the calculations very often because they can only predict up to a point and beyond which the predictions are not very good. So there is a lot you can do. It's just not a nice long-term model that tells you exactly what will happen for a long time to come, because the components are changing so much. And when you have highly complex, unpredictable systems, you get huge potential risks if you don't manage them carefully. I don't think I need to spend too much time talking about systemic risks, since I think what has been happening in the financial systems is a very good example of what happens when people, what's the right term, are not aware of the characteristic of the systems they are managing. So they calculate risks in a very discrete, linear way, and in the meantime, the systems are of the kind we talked about. So, and this is not just a problem in financial systems. I think these kinds of things, risks you find in highly integrated supply chains, logistic systems, development systems in which the development is totally distributed. I think it's fair to say, remember, all this is a background for talking about governance, that we've been managing sort of, we learn management in the industrial economy where things were not anywhere near disintegrated and where there wasn't technology applied to services and things like that. And the managers are here and the environment changed and they're still managing this with potentially catastrophic effects. And that's what we have seen happen. Now, so the only way to cope with this market environment is innovation. I mean, innovation may be lots and lots of things, but the way I think about it and the way I talk about it is that when you're dealing with an environment in which absolutely everything is changing all the time, at the technology level, systems level,
and societal level, innovation is what you need to do to survive. I view it totally as a survival imperative. And the reason for that is if you keep innovating, then you keep adapting to the changes. You're hoping that the asteroids that are killing your competitors are opening up opportunities for you, and you can go ahead and start doing all kinds of things. But if there is no, you can, it's a very existentialist world. You cannot stay put, otherwise you'll die. And in fact, the mortality rate of businesses is large. It's really large. If you look at how many businesses were around, that were around 50, 60 years ago are gone, I think the number of survivals is about 1/6. I mean, it's a relatively small number. And being big doesn't help. You can be big and die, you know, Bear Stearns, Digital, used to be around. The marketplace is brutal. And if you make mistakes, you die. So what is causing these dramatic changes that we are going through right now? And actually, the person who has best studied technology-based revolutions is a Venezuelan economist, Carlota Perez. Yohei, do you know her work? And she's been at the University of Sussex in the UK for several years. And she said that in the last 250 years, roughly, we've had five major technology-based revolutions, and this is the fifth, and that they all have similar patterns. Her book is all about the patterns, and they are very, very similar. And basically, the pattern is that there are about, she has the first phase is when the technology first shows up, and then the technology has to try to make it, eventually it makes it, and then everybody gets excited, and you get a bubble. So the technology goes from being in a lab obscure until eventually starts making it. The financial markets discover, they all start switching their money from the old technologies to the new technologies. They create a lot of expectations that the new technology cannot meet, and then you create a bubble, the bubble bursts, and then after the bubble bursts comes what she calls the deployment period, where the technology is being used in lots and lots and lots of applications of all sorts. And I used to ask her, two, 3 years ago, saying, well, so we are now in the deployment phase. She said, no, the bubble hasn't worked itself out. I said, Carlota, come on. We had the dot-com bubble that burst. And she said then that, look at what's going on with mortgages. Look at the financial markets. Because in her theory, a characteristic of the deployment phase versus, I forget what the first phase, the other phase was called, is that the money goes after production instead of money going after more money. So the fact that we were still in a period of lots of financial engineering for its own sake, in her mind, meant the bubble hadn't burst yet. It had to go through. So in this technology right now, what is really pushing everything is the advances in digital technologies. And you know all this. There is no end in sight. It continues to accelerate. The cost keep dropping. Any technology, by the way, that is of the quality that will cause a technology-based revolution needs to have these characteristics, that it keeps improving a lot and its costs drop precipitously, because if the costs don't drop, it cannot become ubiquitous in society. So the commoditization of digital components is part of but we feel good about it. And then we all know that what's happening more and more with these digital technologies is that they're permeating every single aspect of society, but everything. They used to just be used to make computers, but now they're being, in fact, a way to think about it is that the digital and the physical world are sort of merging. It's a hybrid world, and the merging is because you use the digital world more and more to model and simulate the physical world, and you use digital components to instrument the physical world. Get lots of sensors, informations, and you analyze. So there is a real merger of this world. Now, I do think that the big, if somebody asked me when I would call the transition from the industrial to the knowledge economy, I think it would be in the mid-90s when the internet showed up, because it was the internet that absolutely changed everything. Before, we had computers, and they did whatever computers did. But then when the internet got here and integrated them all together, and we were able to put together the kinds of systems I was talking about before, the whole picture changed. And it totally transformed the nature of innovation in the knowledge economy, being far more open and collaborative, global, diverse, multidisciplinary, because the problems, I mean, as a result of our ability to integrate all these things into these god-awfully complicated systems, if you don't approach innovation in an open, collaborative way, in this global way and multidisciplinary, you won't be able to make progress. It's just impossible. So at some level, these are all corollaries of the environment that we are in. And pretty much people agree that when you look at innovation today, it's far, far, far broader than the way people looked at innovation in the industrial economy. I would say in the industrial economy, people looked at more innovation at the product level, maybe services. So it was technology, product, services. I think that more and more, the bulk of the innovation that we are seeing around us is process innovation, business model innovation. In other words, find new ways of making money. You know, in fact, one of the hardest things to do, it's not difficult to build a product or a service with a new technology. It's really tough to figure out how to make money, and those models that figure it out are totally business model innovations. Culture innovation, management innovations in public policy, which is what keeps pushing us to start thinking very seriously about, so how can we apply innovation-based thinking to concepts like governance that before we would have thought, well, that's it's like services, you know, you just do it. Or you go to business school and they teach you whatever they teach you in business school, and then you do it. Whereas now we can really start thinking it much more how it all happens. Every 2 years, IBM does something called the Global CEO Study. And in 2006, IBM interviews about 1,000 CEOs, and these are personal interviews. They get visited by somebody from IBM's consulting business. And something that was very interesting from the CEO study about 2 years ago is that when you ask them where was the source of new ideas coming from, the vast, the vast majority was from externally business partners and customers, and internally the employees. Now, remember, in the old days, if you ask people, well, where does the innovation come from in your business, they would have probably all said, well, it's my labs. That's why I have R&D labs. Is they go in there, they innovate. No, no, R&D labs invent stuff. But there is a new sensitivity to the question of where do ideas come from that didn't exist in the past. And again, this is all because if you associate innovation with technology, machines, products, things that I would call down the stack, that's what happens in the labs. It's lab-based innovation. But if you start associating innovation with doing things for people, fulfilling people's desires so they buy what you're offering, they'll pay you whatever, then it's not surprising that if the question here is a variant of Freud's famous question, what do people really want, then you have to go to the people and figure out their ideas and make them part of your innovation. And that's what the surveys have been showing for quite a while. And so it's not surprising that given this new sensitivity we all have about going to people to help innovate over the last few years, we've seen the huge rise in social networks and in reaching out to people as communities and get information from them, get knowledge from them, get blogs and wikis and lots and lots and lots of way of extracting insight from this collective knowledge of the people. In IBM, as part of our whole innovation initiative, we have become really externally oriented of making sure that whatever we do, we reach out to all the constituencies out there and see what we can learn from there. Remember, this is, I mean, once you drink the Kool-Aid, this is obvious. But before you do that, you say, but you, I mean, you go to community organizers to say what they want or standard bodies. The answer is, that's knowledge. That's a source of knowledge. And if you want what you are doing to be successful in the marketplace, you need to tap into those sources of knowledge and see what you learn from them and see how do you tap them. And, of course, try to do that in the most social networking way possible so you can apply tools and all kinds of analytical things. IBM has lots and lots and lots of platforms and tools for employee-based innovation to help them gather ideas and see what happens. And of course, in order for innovation to happen and get people to come together and collaborate, a few critical things have had to change. And let me just talk about a few of these changes that have ushered in our ability to tap into collaborative innovation as a way to move forward. Industry standards. I mean, you have to remember that before the internet in the mid-90s, the IT world wouldn't agree on standards. And if you asked anybody if the IT world could ever agree on standards, say, absolutely not. We tried in 1988 with the Open Software Foundation that tried to converge Linux, and the bastards are all at each other's throats, so that will never happen. I really think that the biggest contribution of the internet to the world of IT is that it introduced a culture of standards. The world of IT before internet and after internet were absolutely different. And those standards keep getting fought. You know, the latest one was open document format, where, as you all know, Microsoft has had sort of the key usage in Microsoft Word, and people have come up with a standard way of doing documents. I mean, it feels like having a proprietary document format is like, I don't know, having a patent on the letter E. I mean, it's a nice thing to have, but it seems not in the best interest of society. And so we'll see how ODF is playing out. It has generated a lot of interesting things. If you want people to collaborate, not only they need to be able to read what each other writes, which is why you shouldn't patent the letter E and then nobody can read, or even why it's important that there be open document format. But if a lot of what people will be, if people will be embodying their ideas in software more and more as the language to formalize their ideas, again, it makes zero sense for people not to be able to read their software if they're going to collaborate with each other. So it's a very natural reason why open source communities have come together and they share what each other, what they each do. And I hope you have all read Coase's Penguin, which explains the whole rise of open source communities and what it does. And it's just a natural way of continuing to collaborate. And open source communities will just continue to be a fact of people coming together and working together. And another major thing is to view patents and other forms of intellectual property not just as proprietary. I mean, perfectly fine to also have it be proprietary, but increasingly as ways to enable communities to work together. And, you know, patents are fine, property rights are fine, but, as for example, when the Linux community was being threatened by some really bad people, one of them, I heard, was a visitor here recently, David Boyce, who defended these really bad people. I think the lawyer of the bad people somehow seems worse than the bad people. IBM, that's an aside comment, you don't have to. IBM decided to donate patents to the Linux community to help them. And I think it's going to be interesting more and more as companies try to create ecosystems, shared patents, shared intellectual property is going to be a very good way of protecting the ecosystem and of attracting people to want to be part of your ecosystem by collaborating and working together. So the whole view of intellectual property has to be thought through as you think through the fact that we want to encourage collaboration, because it's the only way that we can attack the problems given the incredibly complex environment we're in. Which then leads me to governance models, which is something I've been thinking in the last few months, especially, frankly, as I've watched the horrible management screw-ups going on in companies all around. Again, the financial crisis being just the latest manifestation, that what is the right way of to think about governance models to get problems done in this very complex environment? And let me share some thoughts with you, but what I'm really much more interested would be to get your feedback on some of the thinking, and some of it I've written in my blog and I think you all got links to it if you do that. And sort of to look at it in a very simple way, I think there are three key governance models: hierarchic or top-down, distributor, bottom-up, and then what I would call balanced, which is a combination of top-down and bottom-up. And the hierarchic model, which is the oldest model, has been very successful if you focus on execution and operations, because you get to organize something in just the right way, and then things happen. And it was the premier model in the industrial economy. There is an assumption built into the hierarchic model. By the way, from everything that I'm talking now, feel free to challenge, because I don't know if what I'm saying is true or not. So I may say it as if I know what I'm talking about, but everything I'm saying, assuming it's a hypothesis. But there is an assumption that there is sort of a management team that knows what they are doing, and they decide strategy and everything else, and then they pass down their wisdom to their employees who execute this stuff. That's more or less the view. It's a view that probably works fine if you are doing incremental innovations, where the next step is clear and the next step is clear, and you can apply a lot of process and do things in a certain way. This hierarchic model, for sure, I believe, totally breaks down when you look at systems of the complexity that I was talking about before. In other words, you take a company like IBM and you try to manage it hierarchically, it's impossible. That is, our CEO, Sam Palmisano, can say whatever the hell he wants to in Armonk, and by the time it gets to, I don't know, Hanoi or whatever, who the hell knows what will happen? So it just doesn't scale. It's perfectly fine if you have a restaurant in Cambridge, it's you and, I don't know, 50 employees, or if you're, there are lots of places where this can work, but for the kind of global integrated organizations that I'm talking about, I don't think it works very well. Then we can look at a distributed model, and the distributed model is excellent at generating new ideas and attacking complex problems, and it's probably one of the most exciting changes in business governance is the acceptance of distributed models as a way to get innovation in a much more bottoms-up organic way. The concern with distributed models, if you want to view them for production, for as a means of production, is that they'll generate the ideas, but somebody has to do something with them. Somebody has to operationalize them. And generally, the distributed model is not a very good way of execution. It doesn't seem to lend itself that way. And that's why I've been thinking much more in terms of some balance between hierarchic and distributed, where you essentially use each depending on what it's good for, and depending on the problem, the boundaries of what's distributed and bottoms up and what's hierarchic and tops down keeps shifting. And it's all depending on the problem. And I tried to, last night as I was thinking about my talk, I was trying to think about sort of how to look at this more graphically, and sort of if I think of here are the people and there is the management team, then if you look at a hierarchic model, then everything flows from the management team down. And, you know, if the people here, I mean, again, let me look at IBM. I say IBM is 350,000 people around the world, and if you add the ecosystem of channel partners and so on, maybe it's 1 million people. I mean, the base is just so big. So that's what I mean by it has problem scaling. If you're just managing, let's say, the Fishkill fab, that then it's a more suitable model for managing the semiconductor fab in Fishkill, but not the whole company. If you look at just communities working with each other, generating ideas, then the problem is, and who is going to get them organized? Who is going to get things done? Which is why I thought of then having then this balance where the job of the bottom sub side is to generate the ideas and to keep filtering them around as much as possible, then when the ideas are in a certain shape, they start now meeting the management team top down, because they have to select the ideas, they have to fund them, they have to give them a budget, they have to get them out there, and there is a shift in boundaries. And I mean, what's so interesting when you think about it, and I'll talk about a few concrete examples of this kind of balanced model, it is much harder to be a good manager of a participatory governance model than to be a manager of a hierarchic model where your job is to pretend you know what you're doing and then you just tell everybody to do that. Because here, you have to really be a very good listener. You have to, your job is going to be get lots of information and look at it and then see how to structure, how to make decisions. So I really do think it takes good management to a whole new dimension than the classic hierarchic model dimension. Let me go, I'll come back to this, but let me give a few examples here. And the Linux community is a wonderful example. And in the Linux community, everybody is aware that the best programmers in the world contribute ideas and code to Linux. And that's why it's so good. And there are lots of other reasons also. By the way, because they have to read each other's code, that forces the code to be well-written. I mean, most code in proprietary software is horrible. Nobody can understand it. But Linux couldn't have survived if the large number of people involved in contributing ideas couldn't read the code. So it's far better structure than anything that existed before. And lots of things get contributed. However, two versions of Linux are put out every year. And there are fixes and so on, and that's not done by the community. It's done by what's called the maintainers, which is it's the management team, and Linus Torvalds is the leader of the maintainer community. So it's a very good example. And Linus, I've been in meetings with him and so on, and he says to people, oh, I'm a terrible manager, that's why I've distributed everything. He's probably, he may be the best knowledge economy manager I've ever met, who has done such an incredible job of getting the trust of the community, motivating them to do the great stuff they do, having huge respect for him, and still get a few releases out every year. I mean, you don't just do that. You have to be really, really good at it. And so Linux, I think it's an excellent example of this balance. And Yochai, I'm sure you've looked at Linux. Do you agree with that, that they've achieved this balance? And by the way, any well-functioning open source communities, you'll find something like this. There has to be a group of maintainers or people like that who take the input from the community and do things with it. In IBM, we have embraced collaboration with a vengeance. And there are lots and lots of things that we do, and people submit ideas. In fact, about a couple of years ago, Sam Palmisano went to our research labs, got so excited, he said, let's do an innovation jam, which is this sort of internet-based meeting in which everybody in the company and sometimes people beyond the company is asked to participate in this three-day community thing. And then people organize it very carefully. There are certain questions, and you join whatever dialogue about those questions. And as the jam is going on, we have these really sophisticated textual analysis programs that are operating in real time looking for patterns. So they keep refining the dialogue, and there are coaches that sort of try to steer the conversation so that the right things happen. And so Sam said, let's have an innovation jam for, you know, I'll invest $100 million in 10 great ideas, but let the ideas come from our people rather than Armon. And he did that, and there were 10 great, you know, virtual worlds was an initiative that I think that got the number one thing. I'm investing in that green, whole set of green initiatives came out of that. Not all 10 have continued, but probably at least half of them have continued. But again, the ideas come from people and they refine them, but eventually you need a management team. First of all, the $100 million come from the top, so you need at least somebody that will write the $100 million check and keep managing this stuff. And if you look at all the management in companies like IBM and others, you'll find hopefully a good team that is matching up with the community, trying to get things done. In government, and I'm spending a huge amount of time now thinking about participatory governance, because as you know, our next administration really wants to move much faster in that direction. And what does it mean to have more participatory government? One very good example that was put together with Beth Novick, you know Beth, right? Who is at the, she's at New York Law School and also in Stanford University. I think she's there on sabbatical. One huge problem has been the examiners of patents are absolutely overloaded, and people are writing patents, and they write, I mean, a lot of patents are written in a really bad way, and they just dump them to the examiners, and they're supposed to do that. So the idea, and Beth was the leader, but people in IBM were very involved, and some people in Wharton were also very involved, is why don't we invite the community to comment on the patents to give advice to the examiner? So again, eventually the examiners will have to decide, but if you have information that says, you know, there is previous art to this patent, give it to the examiner. Don't force it. So this is a very good example of applying, bringing the community. And by the way, when it comes to patent, there are people who care deeply about all this. Let them participate and provide input to the examiners and comment on the patents and how they are doing, and let the examiners eventually decide what to do and how to judge it. So these are one example in each of these. One question you can say is, what's the proper balance? And I have no idea. This is all so new, and it all depends on the nature of the problem. You know, if it's a simple problem, I suspect you may not even need a lot of collaboration. You can just go more top-down with limited collaboration. If it's an incredibly complex problem, you really want a pretty broad community, I would expect. There are some problems that are very deep, you know, a mathematical theorem feels differently from healthcare. And so you wouldn't think the balance is in the same place applied to mathematical theorems than in healthcare delivery. If it's an area that's relatively mature, it feels very differently than if it's emerging, a brand new area. Again, if it's something emerging, you would think the input from people are far more important. If it's mature, we understand it better. And if it's a tactical area where there is an urgency in making a decision, you would think, again, you'll have a more top-down versus if it's something that's more long-term strategic. So these are all ways to think about it. And what I wanted to do now in the discussion is sort of get your thoughts on these kinds of ideas and what kinds of problems we can attach them to, and what do we need to do. Let me just give you one that I'm also now working in participatory governance. So a number of us have been members of presidential advisory committees. I was a member and co-chair of something called PTAC, the IT Advisory Council. And it's an interesting question, why do we need an advisory council where people have to come to Washington 4 times a year, maybe it was 3 times a year, meet and whatever. Maybe we only have to come once or twice a year. I do think you need to meet people, and the way I think about it, exchange pheromones, whatever that means. That is, it's a lot of communication that happens being in the same room with a person. So you should have that, and it facilitates the virtual communication. That's a whole other discussion. These are problems actually being researched in the media lab at MIT. But maybe other meetings can be virtual, can be done in a social networking environment, or can be done in a virtual world environment. And part of advisory councils usually include open meetings. Some of our meetings were closed, just the members and staff. Others open to anybody who wants to come. You can do the same thing, have open meetings. And then you can start saying, well, but Irving, once they are networked instead of physical, that is virtual network, what additional innovations could we have? And I've discovered there's something called FACA that I'm now trying to get some lawyers to explain to me. Federal Advisory Council, I don't know what the act, where there are laws that govern what you're allowed and not allowed to do. So it's an interesting question. Advisory councils sound perfect to bring into this collaboration and governance. And I don't know what the limits of the law will be. I don't know if any of you have any thoughts on that. And for sure, my thoughts here would be, we had our meetings in the NSF building in Arlington, And to get into the building for the open part of the meeting, you needed to say, you know, you needed to show identification. So I would expect if you want to come to our virtual meeting, you cannot be Mickey Mouse. I mean, you have to, you know, it's totally reasonable to require an identity of some sort. I would expect that. But there are lots of interesting, you know, you almost feel like you are reinventing a lot of the mechanisms of society in thinking these things through. In healthcare, it's an area I've been a visiting professor in MIT for a few years now, and it's one of the things we're trying to understand. And there is a question, how much can you use community-based approaches and collaboration approaches to help, to have patients help each other with common problems, whether it's breast cancer or brain trauma with returning veterans, and be much more truly self-helping? And what's the role, who would organize that? Would the hospital do that, and or the some healthcare provider to guide it? What would be the ethics? And there are some very interesting, obviously you want privacy and so on, but there are a lot, I mean, it feels like the right thing to do, because more and more surveys are showing that people trust much more peers than hierarchical members. And, you know, again, I would expect a collection of people with brain trauma trying to talk with each other how they're feeling, maybe more trusted than, I don't know, the psychiatrist or whoever, just talking about what it is. But there are some very interesting questions in how do we apply this. Please.
Irving, I'm actually very interested in this top-down plus bottom-up type of paradigm for distributed development, coming at it from sort of an industry perspective, and out here from Hollywood, and I saw Yohai speak with Professor Jenkins at the MIT, teaches in the past week. So we're coming at the same problem from the perspective of distributed development for outsourcing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that could be for a transmedia product, for a studio that wants to develop IP across multiple platforms, whether it be games, plus movies, plus internet. So they have different market verticals that are right now kind of disparate,
mm-hmm.
because you've got the advertising industry, you've got television, and all sort of work across us. And how to plan for that using a few things. And a couple of the things that sort of are coming into play is we're having to develop something that we're right now calling a transmedia template,
mm-hmm.
where the person who's doing the top-down adoption,
mm-hmm.
is planning from the very beginning the template of what am I budgeting for?
Yeah, of course.
So what am I laying out cost,
mm-hmm.
and planning for, and laying out kind of the template around that,
mm-hmm.
across different types of
right, media, right.
different groups,
right.
different levels of supervision and management, all the way down to the bottom, which is the discrete vendors. So whether you're a vendor who supplies animation or rotoscoping or a discrete service, you fit in somewhere along
right,
those levels.
Right, right.
So if you have that type of template and you're using something like you're incorporating tools like centralized databases,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Access levels of what
right.
you want people to have access to from different communities,
mm-hmm.
and also automation, like
mm-hmm.
business automation that you're using for CRM.
Mm-hmm.
If all of those worlds sort of converge, you're starting to get that model just like you showed,
mm-hmm.
where you've got this map that you've planned out with different access
right.
and different levels of
information.
Right.
And what was the reaction of the audience? I mean, were they culturally, I mean, it was MIT and Harvard, so I'm assuming they're more open to this idea.
Oh, with regard to my idea, I
yeah,
was an attendee.
Oh, okay.
So I found it fascinating from a transmedia perspective.
Yeah, Henry Jenkins is very open.
Yes. So all of these ideas are crossing over into that whole transmedia space and
yeah.
how people
But what's so interesting, and it reminds me of what you have written in Cosmic Penguin, this is revolutionizing the whole nature of an enterprise. And it could revolutionize government. I mean, that's what makes all this so interesting, that, many of us feel when you're dealing with such complex organizations, this is the only way you can do it.
And does IBM have a type of system they're developing?
Well, but there isn't just one type, because again, what you would use to get new ideas in a research lab versus get a goddamn machine out the door to sell before the quarter ends so you can book the revenue. That's a very different, that's sort of strategic versus tactical. Here, the urgency is so huge, it's going to be really disciplined. So there are many systems. There isn't just one approach, and we're all learning. I think that's the best way I can say that.
So let's push a little bit. So here's, when I see your balance makes it seem like it's got to be better, right? let's push a little bit. So there's a problem that I think whenever people look at collaborative activity and intrinsically driven activity, of how you deal with people's motivations when they are in social and interpersonal relations versus when they are in relatively structured and controlled situations. So a story of a complexity that might be in such a system is that when you're in a distributed system and you know there's no boss, as it were, or if there is, it's very flat. Because one of the things that, I mean, you talk about the Linux kernel development community and Linus Torvalds' role in it. But what's interesting, you can't say the same thing about Jimmy Wales in Wikipedia. There, it turtles all the way down. It's distributed governance with consensus all the way down. And nonetheless, there's a reasonably well-structured product at the end that is a learning product.
But the Jimmy Wales and company, there is a management team, right? It may be thin, but
it's not entirely clear to me that it is in the same way that you can talk about the Apache Software Foundation or the kernel development team. There's a lot more of required consent.
I understand.
Even in conflict resolution, there'll be seven range. So the thing that I'd be curious, and in some senses I'd almost want to ask you specifically about the Innovation Jam application, because it strikes me as a place that would be interesting. So Innovation Jam, here's a company investing a lot of money, trying to make a lot of money, with a clear command hierarchy in the sense of who ultimately can decide. One story that one could come out at from the literature on crowding out or non-separability of social preferences from extrinsic preferences, which is generally applicable to this problem of control system. And the nice thing is you're talking about structured systems of collaboration, so that you can easily convert the diversity of insights into specific.
Yeah, which is the point you mentioned. Of a template, otherwise you would think it's really difficult to do that.
But the question there becomes, to what extent, what's the shape of the structure there? To what extent, for example, how does moderation happen in such a way that people don't feel like their views are discounted and it doesn't matter? How is the contribution framed? Are people paid to contribute their ideas? Internal or external? Is there a formal reputation system of some form or another? Is there
what are the specific structures that allow people to feel that their views are valued?
Yeah, yeah.
And to have a conversation and at the same time not lose all of that when you add the structure, when you add the conversion function.
Now, it's interesting. In Linux, as you know, it's very reputation-based. It's a really big honor to have the module you submitted be accepted by the maintainers. It's a big honor. So that's why people do it. No different than if you get it published a paper in a reputable journal. That's why people do that. I know in Cosmos paper you have to explain why would anybody donate their work, and then the answer is, boy, human beings do a lot of stuff for reputation, like a lot of stuff. So that's not different. In Innovation Jam, it's not just in jams. IBM has had jams on all kinds of things, not just innovation. There is no reward. It is structured to the extent that the questions ahead of time are set out, and you put them out there so people can think about it. There are always a couple of moderators who tend to be senior executives that are volunteering to do this. And I think that what happens is everybody knows that Sam and the senior team really cares about this, that it's not just let's be nice to the masses. You know, it's not that. They know the people really, Sam really cares about it, and it's highly publicized that this is part of our culture, and people participate. They do it, and it may be because that's part of being, if you've been told, you are in the company, so therefore this is a good thing to do. So that's why they do it. Almost like you vote, why do you vote? You don't have to vote, but people vote. Even by the way, in Massachusetts or in New York or Connecticut, where I live, where at some level you can say, the vote didn't count that much, but yet there were long lines. I think people want to be members. Again, this gets back to a lot of the closest thing when arguing.
What kind of particular psychological explanation for why open source people, why people contribute to software? It's a particular thing to deal with software. And it goes back to Joseph Weizenbaum's book, The Computer Power and Human Reason book from the early 1980s. And he talked about hackers being so involved in the system, they love to make the system do what they want, the control issue. And I thought, well, of course, this is 1980. He wasn't thinking about open source at all. But I thought, what would be more amazing in terms of power than to contribute a module to Apache or Linux and have 2 million people running your software? And that may be a small part of it. And the same thing, the same motivation.
But that's not the small part. That is, by the way, that's a big part.
Yeah,
this gets back, the role of reputation and brand.
Imagine if your clause gets into a law. That's power. That can motivate people.
Then to Yohai's point, at what point, if IBM is making money from an idea, do you put compensation back to those creators? I mean, is that distributed in any way?
Let me tell you, IBM, in the jam, IBM has a normal recognition where people get money for ideas. I mean, that's a normal thing. Usually the jams are not that kind of heavy-duty ideas, usually. I haven't seen any that are that kind of heavy-duty ideas. But IBM gives out millions every year in awards to people for their ideas. So that happens, but not within what we're talking about. Right now, it could happen. It's just we're not there yet. When by the way, this whole not the jams, but when we had this thing called ThinkPlace, which is a platform where people submitted ideas, and it was reporting to me before I retired from my full-time job in IBM. Originally, it was viewed as that people put in ideas, and then there'll be reviewers who look at it. And then what we decided is, screw it. We don't have reviewers. So the submitting of ideas online sounded good, but who was going to review it? So we changed it around to say, let the community review it also. So people submit it to a community. I don't know, you're interested in XML, which is the protocol part of service-oriented architectures. Submit the idea, the community reviews it, have some senior technical people that can help along, and then if something really good comes up, push it off. So that was the only way we could do this, as opposed to a more classic suggestion. So it's a, this is all uncharted territory here and there. Please.
So I guess my question is about using the same structure, solving business problems to solving government problems. And it's a pretty obvious concern, but you know, when the FCC has public meetings in Memphis or Minneapolis, or you know, anybody with a car can go. But you know, if you have this sort of distributed online problem-solving tool, you know, people with computers, internet access, and a fair amount of free time are going to be well represented. But you know, the poor and working class are not. And so I guess what I'm wondering is that something you think about? And
I haven't thought about that. I don't know. I mean, I'm really remember this hasn't existed.
Yeah.
And we're trying to figure out. But that, I mean, today the same poor people didn't come to PTAC meetings.
Well,
so,
I guess,
I don't know if they come to FCC meetings either.
Unless Comcast pays.
Yeah. We actually had this particular phenomenon of people being paid to show up and fill the seats.
So it's an interesting question. Well, in that model, you can give them all laptops or something.
Yeah.
Well, maybe you could talk about your experience doing outreach in the business community. You know, how do you make sure that all of the best people in the XML world are represented?
No, we don't make sure. In the IBM, there are various. For example, we have in some intellectual property idea gathering, we just reached out to, there was something IBM did, which is creating an IP marketplace. And there, it was just by invitation, academics who were very interested in IP participated. So that one, it's not difficult to control. You give them a URL, a login, a password, and so that's how you can get expert advice. I mean, that's sort of straightforward, and you invite them. But in a lot of this stuff, you know, in Linux, how do you reach out to people? You just, you know, the maintainers say people, gee, I would really like to have this thing happen, or people on their own want to submit things. The community self-selects what they want to work on, although the maintainers can say, you know, this module really is not very good. It would be nice if somebody fixes it. So, or in the IBM jams, we could have done it and nobody showed up. That wasn't the case. So there wasn't, I think you were, it's almost like, you know, giving this lecture, you know, I don't know. We could have done this and nobody came. So at some level there is that kind of a feeling of let it be as natural as possible. And what we don't know yet is, because it's network, what additional things can you do? Yes, please.
I have another question, which is in a way of follow-up of the equation of governance, enterprise, and community. It seems that while this glass ceiling of the combined method would be neutral in an enterprise environment, it would be highly against the ideology and the ethics of communities, and maybe even normatively wrong in the governance when we think of the power of the constituencies as limited by some kind of management structure. The question is...
In open communities or...?
In communities, I think it's maybe against the ideology and the ethos of communities as actually in the way that...
But it depends on the community. Because remember, open source communities are communities and they're all comfortable with the management system. They are, because otherwise the damn software wouldn't come out. Seriously, they are. And I mean, I honestly think most, you know, there are communities like Facebook where people just, I don't know, can tell stories to each other or whatever, but they don't produce. Facebook is not the production community, right? There's a dialogue community, but if you're supposed to produce something, you know, the answer may be to elect the members of the community. That's an okay model. Elect your own manager.
Although it's not one we actually observe. It seems much more of a somewhere between meritocracy and accession. And it's not necessarily only software. And Aaron, you can talk a bit about daily costs and the structure of the masthead, just as one example, where it's about as ideologically mobilized a community as you have, with a fairly well-structured organization, with a group of people who actually use the term masthead, which borrows from the traditional media model of people with power to decide what goes on, even though they don't have. Am I overstating, do you think?
The extent to which the masthead folks at DailyCos have the authority to decide what goes on the front
page? Have the practical role of structuring the debate in such a way that something more coherent emerges? Or is that just me projecting on it?
Yeah, it's, I suspect there would be examples for both arguments within DailyCos. I mean, that's the hard thing about it, is that they have technical tools that make it possible for debate to emerge in an unstructured way, and they have technical tools that make it possible to make sure that certain debates are given certain priorities. So,
you mean like textual analysis and things like that?
Oh no, I mean much even more simply with, I mean, it's a blog, right? So they have, the authors that are on the masthead have the ability to decide what goes down the front and center of the page every time a visitor comes to the homepage. But they also have the ability to go out and find really interesting things that are buried in user pages and pull those up and put those on the front and center as well.
Steve?
You have been mentioning reputation, and it got me interested also in the comments from the Hollywood case, because it's a good example for the following. How much within the participatory governance as balanced governance, do you need good citizens or good community members, good laws, or just one of the two, and is it one of the two sufficient? And let me put it this in another way. There's an economist called Sam Bowes who has been working recently on the idea of kudunomics. The kudu is a huge antelope that back in the ages of before any agricultural society, it was a big antelope that it was very hard to catch. So if one hunter was able to catch the kudu, he was so successful, he was well recognized, but then he had the problem of keeping the property rights over that huge catch. And then he ended up having to share this with everyone.
Yeah.
And it was very hard to share, to keep for yourself, I mean, because of many reasons. So the social norm ended up being you have to share a lot, so you have to get a lot of help from people, and the more sharing happened within the community, the easier it was to get that big, great idea. And that's, in a sense, a lot of what is going on with the knowledge economy, and Hollywood is a good case in the sense that that unique song that is going to be the top hit, that unique movie, that unique software program, that unique game for Nintendo or PSP or whatever, is one of those few kudos that are out there. But once you catch it, once you produce it, it's very hard to keep it under private property rights. So the norms begin to be, how much do you need to be a sharing person to be able to produce this, or a sharing person to be able to contribute voluntarily to make this produce it.
Yeah.
Although, or within only selfish agents, would it evolve that you can have these great ideas?
Yeah. Let me tell you my hypothesis. This is really my hypothesis, which is, I think it's true. Human beings are social animals. I think there's been a lot of studies, and human beings like to be parts of communities. So there is a natural
denies by biological imperative to share. And I would add that beyond just the biological imperative to share, if your reputation goes up, so you become alpha male or alpha female, I'm assuming from a Darwinian view, that enhances your chances of procreating. So I suspect that there is a natural tendency to both want to be in a community and in a meritocracy to want to rise up because of the imperative. What I'm saying may be totally not true, but you know, I mean, people have been surprised. God, look at all this social networking going on. You know, why are kids doing it? Well, because we're social animals. So when you provide the tools to make it easier to collaborate, everybody goes on. Why do Linux programmers are so excited about getting their stuff accepted? Because we love our ego strong.
So, I mean, oddly, it looks like most of our friends who usually show up from the Program of Evolutionary Dynamics, everybody here? No, not this time. Usually we have two or three who would have either embraced or pounced on various aspects of the claim. And I mean, even part of what you described would count as actually selfish, non-cooperative, as long as you explain it in terms of...
Why is it selfish?
If in fact the dynamic is one in which when you are sociable and seek meritocracy, you end up reproducing more, then essentially these actions are serving the reproduction of your own genes. So in the way in which they analyze whether something is selfish or altruistic, it would count as selfish because it redounds to the benefit claim is basically then that doesn't matter. Because that's such a gene. What I care about is the phenotypic behavior that actually
I'm looking at the that sounds a little. I don't mean that in a bad way. Academic.
So fighting words.
I know. It sounds. I mean, actually, I'm being more trying to see why social networking and collaboration taken off to the degree that it has taken off. And people do it and they try to do good things. I am very comfortable that there is a perfectly good biological explanation. That's all. Being a physicist from Chicago, boy, you feel good when there are these simple explanations.
Well, I think that there's implicit in your discussion here some distinctions which at least you've helped me to make more explicit, which are the different pieces of the puzzle you're putting together require different kinds of dynamics to make success.
Definitely.
And one of the pieces of the puzzle frequently for production is simple coordination.
Yeah.
That doing something reasonably in order, reasonably on time, is the secret of as you said, much of industrialization of any rate.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that new processes move away from that, step one back. You know, your hierarchy, as you say, hierarchy is very good for execution. And so if you're needing to make sure that everybody's standing in line, putting the proper part in at the proper point, that's hard to do in a wiki. Maybe not impossible. Or if you're trying to build this building next door, you know, I think that the major construction projects are probably not going to be able to be done in a wiki.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other kinds of activities, right. You know, Linux, you know, so if someone does it, you know, 2 a.m. at home and the other person
That's
does
right.
it at 6 a.m., you know, does it matter as much?
That's right.
And so I think you have an opportunity to open it up as the tasks themselves become more either self-coordinating or where external coordination is less of
That's
a
right.
correct.
That's right. No, I agree. But then there is the point that you brought up, which is to the extent that the job of the management is to create templates, you know, which again, that won't happen for this putting up the building,
right.
But for many things, if you create the template, and then people contribute ideas to the template. That's another. So there are some very interesting ways of structuring the problem, but letting the innovation happen by people. And template creation is an excellent way to do that. So everybody knows we cannot just accept any goddamn idea because we will know what to do with it. So if you have a really weird idea, start your own community because this one doesn't know what to do with it.
So hierarchies are doing maybe a little different if it's in a templated world rather than in a time and space coordinated world.
I suspect it depends on the problem, how much template versus, I'm assuming if you said, let's get a whole new story, we don't know what new movies to build, so let's start getting ideas, you may not need quite a template. You may just get a lot of ideas. What you need there is some people with the kind of textual analysis tools that we employed in the jams to analyze the hell out of this stuff and see, you know. So there are different models that can emerge from here.
From your experience, what were the biggest challenges of applying these business ideas into government?
Well, I mean. To be honest, I've only started to think about it recently. We only had the election a few weeks ago. And before that, there was no, I shouldn't say that. Maybe a different administration would also have been open to this idea, but the one that won seems to be particularly open to this idea. I don't know. I mean, for example, with the advisory council, which is sometimes seriously looking at it, people said, Irving, be careful because of there are all these laws. So talk to this lawyer at the University of Michigan, who apparently knows a lot about this before you go too far because of GSA. So I don't know. So do you think there will be legal things that make it impossible?
There clearly will be legal things, but I think one of the things that I think is very helpful to think through the question that Jennifer raised, and I wonder whether it's worthwhile spending now just putting a concrete question on the table, is if you can state, here's a set of design principles for the communications platform. Now let's see which aspects of them bump up against legal limitations. Then you can say, okay, I'm basically building this integrated system. Here's a fit that, you know, it clunks. Let's fit this thing here so that we can actually make it work. And so imagine for a moment, let's say, the advisory councils, which you know about, or let's imagine the notice and comment process in administrative agencies. So if you look at the FCC notice and comment, basically what you have now is a system that was designed in the late 1990s. I believe actually designed with large input from Kevin Werbach, who's now one of the people doing the transition team review of the FCC.
Exactly.
So that's cool to see a decade later. But anyway, that system is one that allows you trivially to upload a comment. So you have tens of thousands of documents with no decent mechanism of searching them, with no, let alone analyzing, text analyzing them, and zero discourse. It's just we're all putting a note on the wall. So back to the question that Jennifer raised, imagine that you have this task. And then you can say, okay, here's what we need that's different from notice and comment. We want a set of submissions. We want a set of abilities to comment on the submissions and review. Which part of this, if any, bumps up against the current Administrative Procedure Act? Can we fix that either by an agency interpretation of how it applies to it, and then let somebody sue and deal with it?
Yeah.
Can we get to that by a regulatory change? For you, thinking about governance as a design problem and an innovation space is new. For us, this is what we do for a living, in some sense. We're thinking about innovation in institutions.
I mean, that's what lawyers do.
Yeah. And whether it's innovation in new contractual vehicles or innovation in public law.
And Yohai, is it possible that what this forces is to try to understand why was this done to begin with? Whatever laws are there were done for a purpose. So sometimes it's good to know so we don't forget, because the last thing you want is to ignore it and then you find out, oh my God, that's why they did it.
So it depends on what aspects you're talking about. I don't know if anybody's spent more time on administrative law than I have, which is to say some. So there are concerns with undue influence. There are concerns with lack of transparency and corruption. There are concerns with making sure that there's a public record of people making their contributions so the contributions don't just get
But all that ignored. Can be done, right? We can do all, we can, you can have a virtual platform that in principle accomplishes everything that you're saying.
Right. Facebook does that, so it's not that.
Facebook does that.
Yeah, you can get comments and one
conversation. And Facebook, by the way, am I correct? In Facebook, there is no anonymity, right?
Well, within Facebook specifically, no.
Well, when you say no anonymity, you mean...
to log in and do stuff, the company always knows who you are.
Okay. On the company side?
Well, the system management side. Yeah.
No, no, because I think, I have a feeling that for these committees to function well, you really, people cannot be anonymous. I may be wrong, but I know that in the present councils, as I said, first of all, the members, the approved, so of course you know who they are, and the visitors have to be approved, and these are not open to anybody. I mean, actually, it's open to anybody as long as you're willing to say who you are. And my feeling is a lot of the worst behaviors one could imagine start to disappear if you don't have anonymity. Am I not correct? That's been observed between MySpace and Facebook.
Well, I mean, it's questionable, though, in the sense that you can also have systems like distributed moderation where if you give, you know, on Slashdot, if you give random every user the right to say yes or no, and if you can't get above a certain number of no's, your comment disappears. That's another way to handle that without they allow anonymous posts, and they're not going to be making policy decisions anytime soon.
Slashdot doesn't seem like a good model for a White House advisory council.
No, but I mean it's that speaks,
good, I like Slashdot.
It speaks to the argument you're making, which is I think the problems have to kind of go side by side with the institutional decisions.
No, exactly.
So I think
I
just wanted to track back to two observations you made earlier for this discussion about governance. In the government, there are also much more specific tasks, and it really depends, I think, what the mechanism would be for those tasks. And just, you know, thinking of it broadly, it goes from a question of what is the will of the people, mm-hmm. and what decision might be best and make people happy or have consent, to where are our enemies located and mm-hmm. how can we destroy them, or so, you know, they're all two things that are varying different scopes in between. So I think the varying information management platforms, I think it will be important for rolling out this effort of e-governance maybe, to really connect them to those different desires, I guess. And that'll be interesting, because I think we're more accustomed now to platforms for voicing opinion and moving towards consensus in that way, which is different from platforms for voicing innovation or innovative strategies
to encourage people to participate in governance, whatever, mm-hmm. again, and we yeah. don't, if you say, well, what do I mean by that? In fact, Johan and I, a lot of these ideas I started to get when we were at the MacArthur Foundation meeting in Chicago a few months ago, and one of the people there gave some very good examples of relatively good, simple things. I think he was running an NGO in Manhattan. He was saying, well, maybe, I don't know, people in the village, when they see a pothole, they can go to the website that whoever fixes potholes in the village has and give that information and maybe even you can imagine extensions where you ask your neighbor. You know,
yeah, and it's interesting in that specific case because it's almost blurring the line between the NGO sector and the government sector itself.
That would be local governance.
Yeah.
So it may be that, in fact, a lot of these things may have to be thought through, the difference between participating in things that are very local versus things that are, let's say, the IT advisory council. You know,
yeah.
There, if you don't have a group of, a group of experts that are approved seems like that's a good model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As opposed to, we'll tell everybody in the world to advise what to do. That probably wouldn't work. Whereas in the potholes, you want the member of the communities, and you have all. So it depends where you're doing that. One thing that I'm particularly interested here is that a lot of our toughest problems in the countries, like healthcare delivery or education, where people keep looking to Washington. Well, my feeling is Washington may be there is nothing Washington can do because they are more local problems. I mean, in our system of government, the bulk of the innovation will happen at a more local level. You know, like in Massachusetts, like state and local, there are some interesting healthcare insurance things, right? Much more advanced than anything in Washington. And so you start thinking, can you use this kind of participatory governance to get much more of a community between the federal government and state and local governments to attack these impossible problems? I mean, these problems are impossible. By impossible, I mean, they're impossible. So you have to think, and one of the impossibilities may be that to try to solve healthcare delivery from Washington won't work because every state, maybe every region might do anything different. But maybe Washington can create an environment to share best practices. Maybe something we thought a lot about is if somebody needs a platform to do something, you don't need 50 goddamn different platforms. Maybe part of the shared practices could be open platforms that one state produces that are available to other states. You know, there are a lot of interesting ideas that are kind of, you could say, well, is this governance? Well, if it's done well, I promise it's governance.
And if it's a public good.
It seems for the public good. Right.
I was wondering if you were aware of an effort towards that, because have you seen the another example of like a government kind of template for a national to state kind of coordination? Have you seen the Homeland Security effort? It's like multi-billion-dollar effort this year they did, and now I'm curious how that's going to change.
Who's doing that?
It's run, it's federal.
But which agency? FEMA would do that.
And I think in the previous years, they've done a huge exercise for bioterrorism.
They did
different one every year. And this year, they did one called the Great Shakeout.
Yeah.
And the reason I knew about it is because I'm in California.
And so that may be a particularly good example to study, to analyze.
Right. I mean, they had like sign-ups from, it was like episode level.
No, that looks okay. That's a very good example to analyze. Please.
Yeah, so when we're talking about this idea of participatory governance, and I wanted to come back to your early comment about anonymity, and you think that...
But what, I'm sorry?
Anonymity,
yeah.
Because, you think Slashdot is not a very good model in this case. But what about Wikipedia model, which not only allows anonymity, but actually thinks this is a very important thing in terms of respecting freedom of speech, but it's not just allowing anonymous editors, but also have a team of people who's doing fact checks, a team doing site checks, and a
I understand.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, my assumption is, you know, in anything, it depends on the level at which you do it. When it comes to, let's say, potholes in the village or in Cambridge, I don't know if anonymity may be fine.
It's complicated because of the context. Imagine that, for example, you're looking for texture from expats on intelligence analysis of conditions on the ground in a place you care about. Anonymity may be valuable.
No,
in which case you need to bring some kind of a filtering system.
Yeah. For high, presidential advisory councils, I would just be really nervous. I would not do that at first. I mean, also, from a PR point of view, that it could be disastrous if somebody starts writing, FU messages. We wouldn't want that. So I don't know. I mean, that's why these things all depend on the problems. I don't think there is one answer. It really depends on the problem. And we don't know enough. I mean, these are all very interesting things to investigate. The really interesting thing is it's happening in business like crazy. I mean, in my opinion, businesses that don't embrace large businesses, these models will be at a horrible disadvantage. Because I think these complex businesses are not, you cannot govern them. So it's not as if, no, Irving, I'm an authoritarian guy. Then I would say you're an idiot, because you cannot actually do that. You need to embrace some form of much more participatory management. Otherwise, you just cannot do that. It doesn't scale. So I think this you'll see this happening more and more and more in business. And the open communities is happening right and left, the social network installed. So there's a lot of interesting learning of what works and what doesn't work, and how to bring those into government and also business models, how to bring them in. It's really fascinating. Please.
There's a simple example to learn from, similar to the potholes, but proven worldwide. And it's a 1-800 numbers for how am I driving. And it's very simple, it's working, and the question is to understand how the cost benefit of that being implemented is really working. But there's probably self-selection in the drivers who join companies who does this, companies who begin to have the reputation that it's nobody listens. In Colombia, where I live, it is, and I have used it, and sometimes some phones, they don't answer. So there's no way to get your message through, and if that begins to be a credible situation, then it's inoperant.
Right.
But in other cases, it does work. So this is one simple example of people participating in a public issue, which is safety in the roads.
Right.
And it's beginning to be thought for example, pollution. When you don't have credible systems from the government side to control emissions by cars, because there is a black market for getting the emissions pass test, maybe you can start that with putting license plates into websites of cars that you see that are looking like polluters.
Yeah.
So these are simple examples for to learn from.
In this process of up and down, we've been focusing a little bit on the process of bringing knowledge up. But then there's the question of what do we do to manage that once it's come up. I mean, that goes to Yochai's point about the tens of thousands of comments to the FCC. Well, what do you do with that now?
No, I understand. But remember, we talked about a few things. One is structured templates. So that filters it. One is textual analysis, which is what we use in the jobs. Look for patterns. And then,
so if they mention the word bluebird enough, then we know that.
But the textual and the tools are really much more sophisticated than that now.
Can you say a few more words about that?
Well, you can do semantic analysis. You analyze whole sentences. You really can. You can do a job that.
And how does that feed into the structure? I'm sorry that I'm.
No,
but sorry, how does that feed into the structuring of the conversation? So. You run the tool, and then the tool begins to say,
most of the running, you really do after the jam is over.
So you're not using textual analysis to tell people, look, notice what's happening, let's talk about it.
We do that too. So the there's probably a lightweight form of textual analysis informing people which subjects are coming up, which opinions, which, by the way, they can say, well, that's interesting, but I don't care. And then when it comes to analyzing the whole thing afterwards, then you do much more in-depth analysis. It works in the sense we get results. And I said, did we get the best 10 results?
So again, when you say we get results, do you have a sense of how it affects the structure of the conversation? Or you're saying, this is what we use to parse this huge flow of text in order to get ideas?
I don't know how it affects. I'm sure people may have studied that. I don't know the answer. But it's important to know that to the extent that one could provide real feedback, the tools exist. Maybe not to the heavy way you would do in a batch mode, but there are tools that can provide feedback and start pruning options that not too many people care, which is a kind of almost dynamic structuring. You can imagine. So those would be techniques to dynamically try to drive toward a consensus. But don't forget, somebody said, well, that's not management. Yeah, the management picked the goddamn tools, and they picked the processes. They just did it not by sitting in their office and reviewing stuff. They did it in a more intelligent way. So picking tools and processes is a big deal.
You talked earlier about drinking the Kool-Aid on this, which is an expression I use a lot. And
I'm sorry, never heard the expression?
No, it's one I use a lot. And it was the same in like encountering this whole world. And I'm interested in what your perspective has been being at MIT and thinking about sort of this whole ideology in the context of educating people who are engineers who could end up being in industry, some of which have not drunk the Kool-Aid on openness and IP and things.
Okay.
So I'm just interested in probably your thoughts.
But first of all, I go out of my way to say this is not ideology. That I'm being, this is very important. Obviously, we'll get into semantic stuff. When you're dealing with very complex problems, I don't know any other way to go at them than to get as much feedback from the smartest people you can find to help you address them. That part is, somebody can say, yes, Irving is ideological because other people, for example, may say, Irving, you should go to the Bible and look for the answers there. But I don't know what to do with that. My view of MIT, in fact, I teach in a seminar, I just came from that, and I tell my students, it's a seminar called Technology-Based Business Transformation, that to be a really good general manager, you need three critical skills. You need to be good technically, otherwise you won't know what the hell is going on, you won't understand the systems out there. By the way, it's fair to say a lot of the executives of the financial companies are not good technically. They have no clue what was going on. That's a problem. You shouldn't be managing something where you say, oh God, I have no idea what's going on. I hope Standard and Poor's does, because God help me, and it turns out Standard and Poor's didn't either. You need to be really good in understanding the marketplace, in having a good business feeling for what's going on out there. And then you need to be really good with people. You need really good organizational skills. Because after all, a lot of our conversation has been very much about organizational leadership. Remember, more important than anything else here may be what does it mean to have this kind of social collaborative leadership that will incent people to want to work with you, help you, give you good feedback, that may be far more important than the other two, because if you can attract really good people, they can help you with other things. And, you know, needless to say, engineers have not always been picked for their people skills. And everybody knows that, and every story about reforming engineering says that. You need to get engineers who are more oriented, and we just have to do that. And I also wonder, I mean, this is a massive PR issue, because if we told children that to be a really good engineer, you need to be very social and very good people skills, we may get a whole different pipeline of people. I don't know, little girls may say, well, why didn't you tell me that before? I thought I had to sit in a corner by myself, you know, solving Fourier transforms before. But I really think these organizational skills are really needed. And by the way, when people don't have this good balance between technical markets, then you see the crisis we're in the financial, I mean, it is really horrific that the heads of these companies didn't know, the regulators didn't know. You had Alan Greenspan saying, oh, we have this great new invention where risk is distributed, so everything is okay. You know, that would be somebody saying, you know, we can build a Boeing 757 out of cloth. We have this new cloth. Well, I mean, obviously, I'm being a little harsh.
Flew for a couple of years.
I'm being a little harsh, but you know, we are in a real problem now. And it's causing a lot of societal pain. And I think it was allowed to happen under people's watches who should have known better. And I honestly think part of it is they didn't have the right skills to be the managers of the really complex problems that we're facing. That's my feeling. They had good skills for 20 years ago, but not for today. I'm sorry.
Well, I just was going to comment also, though, that there was a certain level at which they thought they knew the answer already. And indeed, one of the problems with your coming up and down model is that if you put the people at the top who think they know the answer already, then the filters they will put in place will be those which will confirm that,
right.
And then they will go and do the innovative possibility.
And that's part of the when I mentioned the Kool-Aid, along with that comes a certain modesty that when you're dealing with really complex problems, first of all, the fact that these problems are unpredictable, you know, you have to have a modesty, and I think you would behave differently if you know that and be more careful and get more help. And, you know, by the way, this Kool-Aid is relatively new, right? And the fact that this collaborative approach to solving problems, that this is the right way to do this. This is only 10 years old, would you say?
Depends on who you on somewhere between 25 and 10.
25?
No, it was a collaborative management by Objective and Collaborative Management.
No, but there was no internet. I honestly.
No, but there are claims about early claims about the Toyota production system.
Okay.
Works, particularly organizational sociologists who mapped these claims and claimed them.
But it's really taken off since the internet. So that's really my point. So it's all so new that it's not surprising that people set in their ways who achieved their merit 20 years ago didn't keep pushing. You know, that I suspect there is a lot of that going on, but that's okay because we're talking about the world you guys are inheriting. And the nice thing is most of you think this way already. So.
It was also nice that there was a return to the acceptability of complexity, that there was, at least in the U.S., a political climate and a social climate that poo-pooed complexity. Said, no, simple measures applied vigorously will solve all. And anyway, I think that we
but that's good. I mean, really, it's good that that theory is dead, right?
Or at least has taken some hits lately.
Has taken many hits. I mean, it's fascinating. In my own alma mater, I have to go back there and find out how Chicago economics is doing, because I think it's been somewhat discredited. Actually, the right book. You don't think so?
No, I'm
your lips and God's ears.
Actually, what I really think is that maybe what happened is, at the time when it was first done, it was extremely important and novel, but it was calcified into ideology. And it shouldn't have calcified into ideology. You know, any theory has to breathe and has to keep moving along. And I don't know why the Chicago school stayed behind. That's the part that's hard to understand. They probably wouldn't say that.
Dominance is hard to give up.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, I think so. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.